This is New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm Banarsh Madani-Nejad. My guest, Nasser Qobadzadeh, is a research fellow at the Institute for Social Justice at the Australian Catholic University. His interests lie in the study of many things: Islamic political theology, secularism, state religion society relations, and Middle East, and more specifically, Iranian politics. He has worked as editor-in-chief of the Foreign Policy Service of the Iranian Student News Agency, or ISNA, a communications officer for the UNDP, and head of Information Resource Center for the UNICEF office in Tehran. Nasser has already authored two books in Persian, A Study of People's Divergence from the Ruling System in 2002, and The Caspian Sea Legal Regime, Neighboring Countries and U.S. Policies in 2005. Today we talk about his latest book, Religious Secularity, published by Oxford University Press just a few months ago. Nasser Qobadzadeh, welcome to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. It's wonderful to have you here.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could begin by saying just a few words about yourself, where you were raised, where you studied while you were in Iran, when you came to Australia, your PhD field of study.
Yeah, I grew up in a small city in northwest of Iran, Ardabil, its name is. And it's interesting because this book project is linked to a sort of my personal journey as well. I grew up as a religious person all my teenager time. And yeah, I mean, when I was young, I was very religious. Till the time that when I moved to Tehran, the capital city of Tehran, to go to the uni. And then I started reading, and through the discussions with the friends and with my lecturers back at the uni, Sheikh Besht University, I started changing in terms of my religious beliefs and ideas. And then gradually I realized that it's not just me who is experiencing these things. I mean, it's somehow the product of the lived experience of the Islamic State, that this imposed ideology that wanted to convert us to a good believer, then it's backlashing in a way. And it's the, I'm sure that as an Iranian, anybody will agree with me that it has been a journey for many young generation, a new generation who was, educated and trained by the Islamic State. And then as a student of political science, I became interested, as it's a public interest as well for every single person in Iran to study religion and state relations. As if you go to Iran in every party, even in the weddings, you will see that people talking about the religion and politics. That's so popular topic in Iran.
Yeah.
And then I did my master's degree on the how people values has changed from religious values to more Western or in a way national values. And one of the books that I published, People's Divergence from the Islamic State, is exactly about that. That how, for example, I've explored that how people choose names for their newborn babies. I mean, if you look back to the figures, to the statistics in the early after revolution, particularly for the first decade when there was still this ideological ideas very strong among the people, there are more religious people, religious names that people choose for their own children. But from the second decade onwards, you see more national names. I mean, there are restrictions on the Western names. There are more national names that they choose for their children. And in terms of the books that published, the English language books has been increased after the second decades of the, after the Islamic Revolution dramatically, in comparing with the, for example, religious books, which were supported, sponsored by the Islamic State and different organizations. Later, when I came in 2008 to Australia, for some reasons, particularly because of my disappointment with the Iranian politics, I started working on feminism and multiculturalism for a few years, for 2 years, actually, 2 years of my PhD. And then this 2009 happened, the election and post-election riots. And then I suddenly became very excited, seeing that, oh, there is a changes happening. So, and then I put aside that project and I restarted working on religion and politics. And because I had just 2 years to finish my PhD, I thought that a good idea is to use the materials that I had about the societal secularity. This was not the concept that I used back in Iran, but later when I became familiar with the literature, I find that the societal secularity was what I was working back in Iran for my master's degree. And then I can do a good job as a PhD thesis of documenting that how Iranian people have gotten away from the religious and religious discourse. And then I started working on some of the scholars' works, some of scholars' journey, particularly religious intellectuals' journey, because they were, or they are in a way, the driving forces behind all these changes which has happened in Iran, after the second decades after the revolution. And it turned out to be a very interesting topic, and it became the whole thing that I worked on, and I wrote the book on specifically theological or jurisprudential foundations of these changes which has happened after revolution in Iran.
Okay, great. I want to actually talk to you about, I want to ask you questions about this religious intellectual movement. But I guess before we get there, it might be prudent to just talk about religious secularism as a category. I love when you, I think it's just the very first few pages, when the first time you want to talk about, you talk about religious secularism as a category in your book. You call it seemingly oxymoronic. Can you talk about that?
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you came upon this term, and also why you think it's oxymoronic, and why we, yeah, could you define it a little bit?
Yeah, of course. The first thing to clarify is that I intentionally use the concept of secularity, not secularism. I use secularity intentionally, and I owe this to Professor John Keane, who I had once 6 hours of discussion and debate with him about this concept, and then I finally came to the conclusion that I need to use secularity. I use secularity to distinguish it from the related concepts and terms, which in public discussions usually we forget of making, distinction between these terms. They are very close. And one thing is the secularization. Secularization is a sort of a comprehensive project, one comprehensive social, political, and religious transformation which has been experienced in the West throughout a few centuries. And it's a comprehensive in terms of it solves the problem of science and religion, and it solves the problem of worldliness and next worldliness, as well as at the political sphere about the separation of church and the state. So it's not just about the politics or separation of church and the state. It's a comprehensive societal, political, and even philosophical project. When I say religious secularity, I don't refer to that secularization. And secularization had this dimension of elimination of religion from the public sphere, or people, getting away from religion and being more irreligious, or pushing the religions to the private spheres, which was linked to the theory of the secularization and the modernization in a way. And also I'm distinguishing it from the concept of secularism, because secularism is a political product of secularization in the West, particularly separation of church and the state. It is more political paradigm, and because it's linked with this East, like other East liberalism, communism, and that's why. And the other problem with the secularism is that it is, in a way, demonized in the Muslim world. I mean, throughout the Muslim world, if you travel, everywhere secularism is some sort of the linked with the colonialism, with the imperialism, and with the West. And it is conceived, and correctly it is, as an imported, imposed phenomena. And there is another important and interesting distinction, that the differences between the secularism in a Muslim world and in the West. In West, secularism was, as I said, the product, the outcome of a comprehensive secularization project. And secularization project started much earlier than secularism as a political paradigm. But in the Muslim world, it was actually the secularism as a political doctrine paradigm which tried to give birth to the secularization. That was a political project introduced by the most of the mostly authoritarian regimes in this Muslim world, like Ataturk, Reza Khan, and Muhammad Pasha in Egypt, to secularize the society. It was top-down project to push the religion towards more to the private spheres. So I use religious secularity specifically to distinguish it from the secularism and secularization. And also, I use religion next to the secularity to show another important, and I think that this is very important to highlight, the differences between the West experience and what's happening currently in Iran. In the West, secularism was, in its political form, was the drivers of the secularism were the political philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
Example, John Locke, I mean, as the father of the neoliberalism, he articulates the secularism from a political perspective. His concern, his motivations, and his methodology is more political, lies within the political philosophy rather than the theology. Or, of course, he uses many theological discussions, and his two treatises is formed in a discussion with a theologian. But he's not a theologian. Or other, founding fathers of secularism, like Jefferson in the Anglo-American case, is more political philosopher. He's a president, and then he comes from the political background. But the most important founders of this discourse, which is emerging in the, particularly in Iran, and also you can trace it in the other parts of the Muslim world, they are religious scholars. Their main projects is religion, and this political dimension of religion that they are addressing, which I call it religious secularity, is just one part of their, bigger project, which is a religious reformation discourse. I mean, if you look at Muhammad Erkun, Abu Nasr, Abdullah Naim, all of these key figures are religious philosophers, religious sociologists. And in Iran as well, if you look at like Surush, Kadivar, Mojtahid Shabestari, Eshkivari, Bazargan, they are all, in a way, religious scholars who are working on politics as well. And that's why I'm saying that it's very important to distinguish it from the Western experience, which is more coming from the political philosophy. And
so you're basically saying that secularism is the way that it's emerging in Iran is different from the Western experience, because instead of coming from the emerging as it did in the West from the heart of liberalism and this basically philosophical discussions, is actually coming right from the heart of religion. It's a religious movement in itself.
Exactly. And if you read my book, you will see that always there are references to the Quran, Hadith, and Islamic history. There is nothing, of course, even when there is a talk about the rational reasoning, even that methodology is lied within the religious discourse. There is this Jose Casanova, one of the key figures of the secularism in the West. He argues that the Western secularization process or project as the political dimension of this project was a project to emancipate a public space, particularly economy and politics, mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. religion. If you see for example, in the 17th century, mid 17th century in UK, this 30 years of the religious wars, it is exactly the harm that religion is doing to the politics, the public sphere, and John Locke is trying to save public sphere politics from religion, the heart mm-hmm. of religion, and that's why they are pushing religion to the churches, inside the churches. And it's interesting that John Locke clearly and explicitly, he says that whatever happens within the churches, it's their own business. They can do whatever they want, because the one who believes in their religion and he or she goes to the church, and then after that it's their religious business. But public sphere should be free of religious and religious issues. But this discourse, which is emerging in the Muslim world, in particular in Iran that I'm talking, and it is really interesting to see that how the lived reality, the lived experience of the Islamic State is driving this discourse. They are trying to emancipate religion from politics.
It's the other way around.
Exactly. And that's what they are arguing. That, I mean, this, and if you read their writings, most of the scholars who are religious scholars who are working on this area, they always have the driving concern for them is the harms that politics, state, the political mm-hmm. power has done to religion over the last almost four decades that religion has been, a religious state has been in power in Iran.
Okay, this is a fabulous insight. I really appreciated it while I was reading the book. Could you talk about the central message that you're trying to convey in religious secularity? I mean, I realize this is one of the central messages, but there's a bunch of stuff in there. Could you talk about them?
I mean, there are two components for the whole book. The first component is to challenge the religious foundations, the religious principles that the Islamic State or the so-called Islamic State is using to justify or to locate itself within the religious theological framework. The first components of the book is a challenge or questioning of these foundations or religious foundations of the notion of Islamic State. And the second component is about arguing or promoting the compatibility of Islam and religion with the secular democracy. And I think that because the Islamic State has dominated and is leaning towards forming a form of totalitarian system, both in the political sphere and in the religious sphere, the most of the arguments that has been proposed so far by these scholars are mostly focused on the, in a way, rejection of this proclaimed foundation of a religious foundation of the Islamic State. So I should admit that the second component of the book is weaker than the first component because, in a way, the most parts of the argument is formed in form of rejecting what the Islamic State is claiming. So that's why you will see that in the throughout the book, all this diverse range of the scholars that I have worked on them from very traditional class of the clergy like Ayatollah Grand Ayatollah Montazeri, late Grand Ayatollah Montazeri, to the very modern like Abdul Karim Sirush or Mojtahid Shabestari, they all articulating their arguments against the Islamic State, and they are all challenging from their own perspective, religious perspective, the religious foundations of the Islamic State. Just one important dimension of this religious secularity that I forgot to mention is that it's based on the argument that Islam provides more conducive context for secularity, even in comparison with Christianity. If you look back to the history of Christianity and how the secularization process took place over there, you may say, I mean, in a loose generalization, there were three steps of coming to the point of forming a secular world. The first step was the conflict between being this worldliness and next worldliness. That was a big challenge within the Christianity because in Christianity, the whole world, this world, is aiming to the next world. And you cannot have any ultimate goal in this world. And everything that you do is aimed in a way to the next world or the hereafter. But in Islam, there is no such a thing. In Islam, from the beginning, this world matters a lot. And you never see in a pure Islamic perspective, of asking you to abandon the world. I mean, Prophet Muhammad enjoyed the best things in the life and his followers as well. Nobody said that the wealth is bad or for example, one of the examples that they use in the literature always, in Catholicism, the relation with the opposite sex is just for the sake of bringing someone to this world to have a child. But in Islam, it's not like, I mean, enjoying the pleasures in the life, food and everything is embedded within the Islam. Mm-hmm. And second battle within in the Christian experience was between the science and religion. And again, that sort of battle never took place in Islam. Islam from the beginning was fine with the science. And now Iranian ruling clergy, they don't have any problem of using the latest technology to pursue their nuclear ambitions, whatever it's a weapon or whatever it is, but they don't have any problem with using this all the latest technologies. The third dimension on which Christendom has been more successful in comparing with the Islam is the political area, which is more controversial because of the Prophet Muhammad's 10 years of governance in Medina. And that's the most challenging and in a way misleading historical phenomena for the Muslim in the contemporary world, which the proponents of the Islamic State use or misuse that experience a lot to promote their own version of Islam or political Islam, to say.
So you start the book talking about dominant and marginal Shia discourses on sovereignty, this concept of wilaya or guardianship, or as they say in Persian, velayat. Could you talk a little bit about the dominant sort of discourse on sovereignty and then what the marginal ones were?
The sovereignty is one of those controversial but at the same time very simple debate or discussion within the Shiite world. The very existence of Shiite from the beginning is linked to the concept of sovereignty. What makes the Shiite different from the Sunni is exactly the claim that the Imam Ali, the first Imam of the Shiite or the fourth Caliph of the Sunnis, the Shiite claims that he had divine sovereignty. God had appointed him through the Prophet Muhammad, and then his 12 predecessor, who is his sons, and had the divine sovereignty as well. That's where basically the problem starts. I mean, it's a basically political problem. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, in 1941, when the last Imam, according to the Shiite theology, disappeared for the second greater occultation, they solved the problem in a way. They said that, okay, this political divine right, political divine sovereignty belongs to the infallible imams, which are 12 specifically and nobody else. And since he's not around, he's hidden, he has disappeared, nobody can claim to have sovereignty. And nobody can have a legitimate government. This dictated a sort of apolitical history throughout the Shiite for centuries. And it was dominant till the Safavid era in 16th century, which somehow there was a small changes during the Safavid era. Safavids wanted to have this, I mean, to have a, some sort of the theological counter-argument for the Ottoman, which they didn't want to be a part of this emperor. So they converted Iranian to Shia, and they invited Shiite clerics from Lebanon, Jabal al-Amal, to come to Iran and to participate in the process of converting Iranian to Shiite. And Shiite ulama like Muhaqqiq Karaki, Muqaddas Ardabili, Muhammad Baqir Sabzevari, and Majlisi, they rearticulated Shiite theology by claiming that jurists has, in a way of generic appointment, by the from the head, hidden imam. Hidden imam has appointed all jurists as his representative on the earth while he's hidden, and we have the authority to authorize king, to give the legitimacy to king so that he can rule. And this was a breakthrough in the Shiite history in terms of giving the first giving the authority to the jurists, and then second, to giving the authority to jurists to delegate this legitimacy to, or this authority to the king. And there was this mutual understanding between king and clerics, but still you had a sort of secular setting in a way that clerics were in charge of religious domain, and the king supported them, I mean, throughout many ways, and they gave the legitimacy to the king. So still you had these two spheres, I mean, political, religious, and secular spheres. But again, after Sheikh Ansari, this changed again. Sheikh Ansari, as you know, was one of the prominent and maybe the first marja-i taqlid, the prominent marja-i taqlid in the Shiite history, and he not only subscribes to the apolitical version of Shiite theology, but also he clearly said that whoever who cooperates with the king or any king, they are committing sin. And he became dominant. His theology became dominant for, again, 2 centuries, till the time that Khomeini came in mid-20th century onwards, from particularly from the 1970 onwards, that he articulated this idea of the theory of the Walayat Faqih, which is a big breakthrough from the whole traditional traditional context of the Shiite, both in the seminary, in the political sphere. Of course, there has been incidents and occasions of clerics intervening in the politics, like during the constitutional revolution in early 20th century, but never a single cleric claimed to have both political and religious authority in the hands of a jurist. And that's what Khomeini did, actually. Khomeini eliminated king, and he literally sat on the place of claiming both religious and political authority for the jurist. And that was a big breakthrough from the whole Shiite history. But again, we should take into consideration the fact that even after revolution, when Khomeini took the power and consolidated his power, and the many clerics came into the power, even after that, the most high-ranking clerics, marja-i taqlid, source of emotion, they kept out of the politics. They did not engage in the politics. They did not support Khomeini, and they did not stood against Khomeini as well. They subscribed to the idea of apolitical or quietism, or what I call passive resistance to the Khomeini's idea, because they believed in apolitical position. So except Ayatollah Shariat Madari, who in a way came to politics and openly and explicitly challenged Khomeini, and he in a way supported political action, but fought for the apolitical religion through being engaged in politics. But the other high-ranking clerics kept away, and they kept they remained loyal to the apolitical discourse. And even today, and it's not confined to Iran. I mean, if you look to Iraq, Lebanon, you will see the same patterns. I mean, Ayatollah Khoi never engaged in politics. Ayatollah Sistani still tries hard to keep away from politics as much as he could. Of course, he's dragged into politics, but still you see that he never accepted to be in the position of gaining politics power. And there are many reports that he has strongly advised clerics to stay away from the politics.
So there's something you did that I didn't know, something you talk about, that right after the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, exactly right after the revolution, was not really supporting the appointment of clerics to political positions in the beginning. Why do you think that was, and why did he change his mind?
I don't know. It's one of the puzzles that, I mean, I have no clear answer to that, because I was not in Khomeini's mind.
Sure.
to read his mind. But I mean, when we talk about the Khomeini and his political theory, we cannot talk about one Khomeini. There are few Khomeinis. Khomeini before 1960 is different from after 1960, and Khomeini after 1970 is different from Khomeini in 1978 and 79. And again, in 1980, Khomeini changes a lot. And in 1985, again, there is another change for Khomeini. Let me briefly go to that. I mean, if we have time and if it's all right with you.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, before 1960, Khomeini, in a way, never engaged in politics. And it's really interesting to see that when Tahle Ghani was in politics, he didn't play any role. During the nationalist movement, Nesat Milli Shodan-e-Naf Mosaddegh era. And even when Nawab Safavi was in trouble and he was executed, there are some stories which is not, I mean, we don't know if it's right or it's fake story, that Nawab Safavi at one point, I mean, escaped to Qom and stayed at Khomeini's, seek refuge in Khomeini's place. That's what the Nawab Safavi's wife tells, but there is no evidence for that. But it's obvious that Khomeini did not subscribe to Nawab's cause back then, and he didn't openly support Nawab. I mean, there is no record of that. So Khomeini kept out of politics altogether before Ayatollah Burujerdi died in 1962. And after that, Khomeini started becoming interested in politics or being more engaged in politics. And the first book that he wrote in 1964, I think, if I'm not mistaken, was The Kashful Asrar, and in which he is still subscribed to the idea of the monarchy. He agrees that he defend the position of the monarchy, but he asks the king to apply to adhere to the Islamic rules, Islamic principles, to the Sharia. And he is still in that belief when he went to exile, and in 1971 is the first time that he articulates his ideas of the Walayat Faqih. Of course, before that, in 1969, he had some sessions, lectures in Turkey, where he talked about this idea, but it's not very well documented in the Kitabul Bey. But in the in Najaf, he clearly, throughout the 13 lectures that he gave in Najaf Seminary, he articulates this idea of Walayat Faqih. If you read the Walayat Faqih, you would have no doubt that he puts the jurist, the clergy, in charge. There is no place for the non-clergy. It's the jurist who has the divine sovereignty, who has the divine political authority for in both religious and political dimensions. And it is exclusive political right for jurists. But right in the eve of the revolution, he doesn't talk about the jurist's role. And even he gave, I think, 112 interviews in Paris when closer to the revolution, and the world were realizing that, oh, there's this guy over there and he's maybe becoming the king in Iran. Then the old media approached him in Paris, and he gave more than 100 interviews, and in none of them he mentioned that I'm gonna be a Walayat Faqih or I'm gonna be in charge. Even there are interviews recorded that clearly when he was asked that, are you gonna take any political position, he explicitly and very clearly says that no, I'm not gonna be in politics. I will be just playing a role of supervising. And he says so about the cleric's role in the Iran, future of Iran. And interestingly, when he came back to Iran from exile, he went to Qom. He didn't stay in Tehran, and he asked clerics to keep out of politics, not to keep out of politics, but not to take presidential position, for example, not to run for the presidency. But later he changed his idea and he returned back to his original idea of the Walayat Faqih. I don't know. I mean, there is this argument that you can make that he was playing politics. I mean, he knew what will happen, and he was just playing politics to get rid of his opponents. But it's very hard to make a case for that. Or if his idea had changed during those few months towards the revolution, it's again hard to argue for that. And again, his idea changes later when he is in the power and he tries to practice Sharia. He comes to the conclusion that it's impossible to practice Sharia in the modern world because of the problems that he finds. And particularly, you will recall that in after revolution, there was this huge debate between the parliament and the Guardian Council, which parliament would ratify legislations which were against, in a way, Islamic principles, against Sharia, and the Guardian Council wouldn't endorse them. And Khomeini intervened in that, and later he changes his idea of the Velayat Faqih to the absolute Velayat Faqih or the Velayat Mutlaqi Faqih. And it's interesting that he authorized, from a very religious perspective, violating the very basic principles of Islam. And I have quoted this in the book that he clearly, in response to the then President Ayatollah Khamenei, says that if the interest of state, he says that state is the highest priority of the Islam, and if the interest of state requires, then we can violate the basic principle, like we can put on hold the praying, fasting, pilgrimage, and all other basic principles of the Islam. And that's, again, another a breakthrough of even his early articulation of the Velayat Faqih. If you read the doctrine of Velayat Faqih, he argues for the formation of Islamic State for the sake of practicing Sharia. But later he changes it, and the practice in Sharia is not the basic or the most important thing. The most important thing is preserving the Islamic State. And Islamic State becomes Islamic because it is ruled by a jurist, not because it is practicing Sharia.
Absolutely. Yeah, this discussion about maslahat, maslaha, is and for in the case of Khomeini, his concept of maslahat in Islam is actually really interesting for people who study not just Shiism but Islam in general, because it's the dominant sort of paradigm. But it's a really important concept because the concept of maslahat has become such a dominant way of looking at reforming jurisprudence, and Khomeini really presents a particular strand of this concept of maslaha that's interesting, and I'm really glad you cover it in the book. Okay, so I think that we don't have a lot of time, but I think the most important part of the book is how you cover the religious intellectual movement, and how what you actually say is that it's this religious intellectual movement that starts injecting the religious secularity, the concept of religious secularity into the discourse, the political and religious discourse in Iran, in the early 1990s and beyond. Could you talk a little bit first of all about the religious intellectual movement? And like I said, we don't have a lot of time. And give us some examples of the folks that played the field, and what some of their most important ideas were.
Yep. Religious intellectuals, I believe that they are the main drivers of this discourse, the discourse of religious secularity. And maybe their most important contribution to the whole religious reformation discourse, not just religious secularity, but religious reformation discourse, is challenging the exclusive authority of the clergy, not only in the political area, but also in the religious area. They are presenting themselves as a sort of someone who can speak for religion, who can interpret religion, and also articulate religion in a much better way than this traditional clerics. The concept of the title of religious intellectuals were coined first, as far as I know, by Abdul Karim Surush in 1980s, for whom the difference between religious intellectuals and religious scholars or religious leaders is not in the way that they are trained or the way that their dress is different, but particularly in using extra religious sources. The religious intellectuals do not confine themselves to the religious sources, not to the Quran, Sunnah, or Islamic history. They go beyond that.
They could be clerics.
I mean, with this definition, you can say Mujtahid Shabastari, Kadivar, even, Ayatollah Muntazir is a controversial to include in this category because he's very religiously oriented person, but Eshkevari, Kadivar, and Mujtahid Shabastari, Emid Ahmad Qabil, and they can be called as a religious intellectual. And it's really interesting because religious intellectuals are challenged by both seculars and religious leaders. By seculars, even someone like Jawad Tabatabai or much more secular people outside of Iran, they challenge that, I mean, intellectuality and religiosity cannot go together because when you are religious, at some point, reason doesn't work for you because you are religious. And from a conservative or traditional perspective, I mean, there is no need to explanation that because they see their authority in challenge. I mean, particularly if you go and read the Misbah Yazdi, you will find out that his concern is very legitimate in a way of seeing this religious intellectual as a threat for the very existence of the clergy and their position or their authority in the public sphere. So, in Iran at least, the whole discourse of religious reformation and in particular religious secularity started with Surush and followed by the other religious intellectuals. And they, if I summarize their argument in a way, I can say that they challenged the basic tenets of the Islamic State in three ways. One is that they argue that there is no blueprint for the government and governance in the Islamic sources, Islamic teachings and principles. They read Quran and Sunnah, Hadith, and they argue that there is no any saying, any verses in the Quran or saying by Prophet Muhammad or even infallible imams who would tell us what form of government we should have. Not for the contemporary world, but even for their own time, they don't subscribe to any form of governance. And the second challenge that they introduced to the Islamic State is by rereading the Islamic history, particularly if you read the very initial years of the Islamic history. You will see that in a way, the political matters is left to the people to decide. And following the Abdul Razak, who wrote this book in the 1924, after just the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and he argued that Prophet Muhammad had a two position. One was the political position, and the other one was the prophecy. And his political position was just a historical phenomenon, a historical occurrence. It was not a part of his prophecy.
It was accidental.
Accidental in a way. They argue for that, and they distinguish between political position of Prophet Muhammad and his prophecy. And also, for example, Mehdi Bazargan investigates the way that the infallible imams lived their lives. And they did politics, and he concludes from investigating their lived experience, he come to the conclusion that there is no such a thing as a divine sovereignty for the infallible imams, which is in a way the basic tenets of the Shiite, and he in a way challenges that one. For example, he says that Imam Ali accepted the governance. And clearly Imam Ali said that I am accepting governance, that being the ruler because the people is asking me to do so. Otherwise, I wouldn't go for that, and he didn't challenge. Of course, he believed that he is the better person to rule the Muslims, but he didn't believe in the divine sovereignty. Or Bazargan refers to the Imam Hassan's agreement with Muawiyah. He says that, I mean, would you agree that Prophet Muhammad could negotiate his prophecy with Quraysh? He would never do that, because that was a divine sovereignty, divine will, that prophecy was handed to Prophet Muhammad. But Imam Hassan negotiated the political position of the caliphate, and he gave it to Muawiyah. And even in the contract that they signed, there is a clause which says that after Muawiyah, it will be the people's decision to decide who is going to be the next caliph. And Imam Hassan revolt against Yazid because Muawiyah appointed Yazid violating his agreement with Imam Hassan. And again, he goes back saying that Imam Hassan revolted because the Kufi people invited him to be the ruler. Otherwise, he wouldn't revolt. And Imam Hussein has never said that I have the divine right or the God has appointed me. You cannot find any statement like that. So scrutinizing this political history of Islam is another way that these religious intellectuals, I mean, use to challenge the very notion of Islamic state. And Bazargan is not alone. I mean, you see that Eshkevari uses the same arguments, Bahariya Yazdi and Kadibar as well. The other argument that they make is, and also from the historical perspective, they refer to this long history of Shiite and Shiite tradition of apolitical history, and they, particularly Kadivar, has a very comprehensive project about that, to show that how this idea of Velayat Faqih, or the rule of jurist and divine sovereignty for jurist, is quite new, and it's a sort of what in Islam it's called a bid'ah. It's not original to the Shiite theology. And the last another important dimension that they address is the impossibility of practicing Sharia in the modern world as from the position of state, as the state law. One of the ways that they argue for that is that the Sharia has got this voluntarily nature. You cannot practice Sharia unless that you voluntarily subscribe to the Sharia, to the Islamic principles. And if the state take authority of imposing Sharia on individuals, on the believers, then it will lose its very essence of being voluntarily, and it cannot be practiced in this way. And also they refer to the lived experience of the Islamic State in Iran, and that how Islamic State has done many harms to the religion. The Fiqh al-Maslaha is a good example that how even Khomeini in a very articulated way violated the principles, or authorized the state to violate the principles of Sharia. But they talk about the hypocrisy which emerged after revolution, and they talk about that massively, about that how people are less religious nowadays in comparing with that the way that they were before revolution. And they say that this experience has not increased religiosity, but what the Islamic State has done in Iran is some sort of hypocrisy, making people to pretend that they are religious, not to become religious. And also this challenging the very socio-political dimension of Sharia is another way that they use to challenge proclaimed Islamic State, the notion of Islamic State. And their argument is that the socio-political dimension of Sharia, those principles and the principles which is in the Sharia, and they are contextual, and they are responses to the questions of the revelation era in the Prophet time. And you cannot apply those principles to the current time, which is the problems, the questions and issues is totally different from that era, from the revelation era. And they challenge the Sharia's capacity to answer the questions or the problems that we have nowadays. This is a one of the important distinction between Khomeini and those who subscribe to the idea of, in a way, political Islam, which is more widespread issue, and in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, Islam is the solution, is the slogan to use for that, which claims that Islam has got answers for everything because Islam is the last religion, it's the seal of the prophethood. So whatever that we need, we can go back to Islam, to the Sharia, and we can find solutions and answers for that. And if we are lagging behind the West, behind the West modernization, it is because we haven't looked back to the religion, we haven't used the religion. And it was not confined to Khomeini, it was all over the Muslim world, even religious intellectuals, to say so, like Ali Shariati subscribed to the idea that Sharia can provide us with everything that we need. And for example, Abdul Karim Suresh argues that Sharia is mostly about the legal dimension of religion. It doesn't cover even the ethical or spiritual dimension of the religion. And the problems, the issues, the questions that we deal in the contemporary world, they are not all legal issues. I mean, they are far beyond legal issues. And this legal knowledge, Sharia as a legal knowledge, cannot provide us solutions and answers for all the issues that we have.
Okay, so let me ask you this. The religious intellectuals that we're talking about here, can you give us an idea what they propose this logistically on the ground as far as political systems go? Can you tell us what they propose as far as a political system goes that contains religious secularity?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I mean, this is something that it is in the process of being unfolded. I mean, it's in process of being articulated. As I mentioned earlier, because the Islamic State is very dominant, and it is leaning towards creating this totalitarian authority within the religious and political domain. So the most parts of their efforts, this intellectual religious intellectuals' efforts, have been channeled towards challenging the religious foundation of Islamic State. So what you call it, it's an affirmative part of the discourse is not unfolded enough yet. And I mean, there are many questions to raise over there. But generally, you would say that one way of articulating for the secular democracy is that they disqualify religion from offering a proposal for the governance. That's one thing. And that's what they have focused so far, to disqualify religion, Sharia, and religious teachings from politics, or removing sanctity from politics in a way. And when they get there, you would say that they generally say that, I mean, to put it simply, of course, it's very complicated. There are different articulations for that. But to put it very simply, they say that, so, okay, it's left to us to decide what to do. Us as a human being, as a believer. And since the democracy, secular democracy, is the latest findings of human being, and I mean, there are direct quotes from them, I mean, for example, from Kediver, I think that is that it's not the product of the West, it's the product of the humanity, which has come to this point that secular democracy is the best alternative, best governance system that we have. It doesn't say that it is the perfect one, but it is the best that we have already till now. And that's why the logic tells us to subscribe to that idea. This is the simplest way of putting that, how they articulate to subscribe to the idea of the secular democracy, but there are other more articulation within the traditional context as well. For example, Ayatollah Montazeri has got his own version of the subscribing to the idea of democracy. He offers this theory of elect in contrast to the theory of appointment. He goes back to the Islamic jurisprudence, Shiite jurisprudence of the generic appointment and specific appointment, nasba am and nasba khas. And he agrees with the idea that there was 13 in a way, specific appointments by God, and one was Prophet Muhammad and 12 imams. And after that, we don't have any specific appointment. And it's a generic appointment in a way that all clerics, jurists are appointed to, in a way, manage the Muslims' affairs, both religious and political and social. But he puts five scenarios within the religious context that how to appoint one jurist as the ruler among the all jurists, because there are thousands of jurists. And it's very, very challenging problem, because this problem has been with the Shiite theology for centuries. As I said, hidden imam disappeared, and 6 days before his disappearance, apparently, he had four deputies back then during the smaller occultation, Ghaybat al-Sughra. And the last deputy, 6 days before he died, he brought a letter, apparently from the hidden imam, in which he said that this is my last deputy and no one else, I'm appointing no one else after him, and no one until the time that I come back, no one can claim that I claim to be representing me. And it is in a way accepted among the old Shiites. There is no dispute about that. And this leaves Shias in a very paradoxical situation, that they can never create a sort of hierarchical system. And Sheikh Ansari tried this in a way of saying that Marja-i Taqlid-i Alam, or the most knowledgeable source of emulation. But again, they had this problem of what is the most knowledgeable. I mean, how you define which one is the most knowledgeable. And that's why that the Shiite theology was left in a way of pluralistic system for centuries. And you had these different clerics. And Montazeri uses this history, this theology, to argue that there is no way, religious and rational way, of appointing or selecting, choosing one jurist who would have authority over the other jurists as well as the nation. And that's where it comes to the idea that...
You mean political authority?
Political, as well as religious. I mean, as well as religious, because even in the religious context, of course, it's what Khomeini claimed for the Wali Faqih, to have religious authority over the other Marja-i Taqlid as well. And that's what Khomeini is trying to do, in a way, to be a prominent Marja-i Taqlid and to have authority over the other Marja-i Taqlids. But it doesn't work, because it has got this long history of pluralistic system, and everybody could have their own idea. And even being Marja-i Taqlid or not doesn't matter. For example, you have this experience of Nawab Safavi, who challenged the Ayatollah Burujerdi's authority. He went to the seminary. He said that, I don't subscribe to your idea. He was a very young cleric and didn't have proper training, but he was in position, I mean, from theological perspective, of rejecting the authority of the most eminent Marja-i Taqlid back then. And Ayatollah Montazeri uses this rich traditional history and theological foundations to argue that there is no way of choosing a jurist. So what we are left with is to go to the believers and to give them the authority to choose one of us. Still, until the last day of his life, he still believed in the jurist's political engagement, and in a way he advised and he preferred jurists to be a political leader. But he said that it should happen through the popular sovereignty, through the people's consent. if people choose one jurist, then he has the legitimacy and authority to be their leader. Otherwise, there is no any valid or credible justification for the jurist to be the ruler.
Right. Well, Nasser, I've taken up a lot of your time. I just want to ask if there's something we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about.
No, I think, yeah, we talked about everything that you... Yep. Yeah, that's fine.
I want to thank you for joining the program. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book. It's very informative. It's a very timely, very important book. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.